On this work, I'm collaborating with my colleague Hongming Wen Zhongfang from the same institute. I'm also collaborating with Fang Chen and Andrew Bernalik from Princeton University. And yeah, here is the outlook. Let me start from introduce to you a new state of matter. It's called topological sand metal. So strictly speaking, topological sand metal, you can understand it from two ways. So one is from the metallic way, it's a special kind of metal. So special kind of metal in terms of it has a vanishing Fermi surface. So the Fermi surface of this special metal is a point or a line in three dimension. So then you can also, at the same time, think about it from another point of view. It's a special kind of insulator. So it's a special kind of insulator in terms of the gap only closed at some isolated points or lines in three dimension. So usually these kind of material, they have a band crossing point right at the Fermi level. So then so far we can classify all these topological sand metals in three classes. So one is called wild sand metal. So in wild sand metal, these two bands crossing at the Fermi level, they don't have any double degeneracy. So they are non-degenerate states crossed at the Fermi level. So then the second type is called the topological, the Dirac metal. So in this class, there are two bands with double degeneracy. They cross at the Fermi level. So then the third class is called the nodal line sand metal. So in this class, there are actually the crossing points of the bands. They form a line, not isolated points in three dimension. So in today's talk, I will focus on the first class. It's a wild sand metal. So then these so-called topological sand metal usually is immaterial. They are formed by as a consequence of band inversion. So after band inversion, you have crossing points near the Fermi level. So if the system at the same time breaks also time reversal or inversion symmetry, so to lift the spin degeneracy, so then you have chance to have wild points near the Fermi level. So then a little bit of mathematics. The wild equation is actually first introduced in high energy physics. So then, but in condensed matter, the wild equation is looks very different with the wild equation in high energy. So then, this is because in condensed matter, the space are not uniform. So we are living in the solid. So it's very anisotropic space. So then, near the crossing point, we can always write our Hamiltonian in terms of 2x2 matrix. So the low energy physics is only about this two band which crosses near the Fermi level. So the Hamiltonian is always can be extended by the Pauli matrix. So we have three Pauli matrix and we have three spatial directions. So near the crossing point along each direction, for example, along the x direction, we can expand our Hamiltonian using this Pauli matrix. And along y direction, we can do the same. And along z direction, the same. So along each direction in the isospin state. So these two states cross near the Fermi level, we call it isospin or pseudospin. So in the pseudospin state, we can define three vectors, Vx, Vy, and Vz. So then we can define the chirality. Oh, here, there's a typo here, so it should be Vz. So it's, we should define by the sign of this quantity. So Vx cross Vy dot Vz. So this quantity must be non-zero. Because if it's zero, then the crossing points is not just points, they form a line. So as long as the crossing points are they are isolated points, so near the crossing point, this quantity must be non-zero, and we can define take its sign as the definition of the chirality. Then at the same time, we can also write the above Hamiltonian in a matrix form. So this V is actually a V matrix with the beta index representing the three directions in K space, and alpha is the three directions in pseudo spin space. So then this V matrix is actually is linking the pseudo spin space with the momentum space. So then this V alpha beta is a 3 by 3 real matrix. Then we can always write this matrix in terms of a standard form by using the singular value decomposition. So then the singular value decomposition tell us that the V matrix can be written in terms of L lambda R, and both L and R are actually unitary orthogonal matrices in this case. Then they rotate our basis in pseudo spin space and in momentum space respectively. So then this lambda matrix is a diagonal matrix with all the matrix element being positive, non-zero and positive. Then using this singular value decomposition, we can write the Hamiltonian in its standard form. So in the standard form, we do not have the crossing terms. So we rotate our basis in both pseudo spin state space and the momentum space. Then after rotation, we are actually call it the principal axis. So in terms of this standard using this principal axis, this Hamiltonian can be written in terms of keep only the diagonal terms. So then the eigenvalue of this Hamiltonian can be simply written as the following. So it's just so this lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3 are actually three velocities along this principal axis. Then if one of the very important property of the wild set metal is that if we add a small perturbation to this Hamiltonian, if the perturbation is, say, it's K independent, then we can only shift the crossing terms. For example, before the perturbation, we have a crossing point at Kx equals Ky equals Kz equals 0. So once we add a small perturbation, we can again solve three linear equations and just allow these three terms inside the square root to be zero at the same time. So that gives us three linear equations. And we have three variables, so Kx, Ky, Kz. Then in principle, we can have the solution. So then this small perturbation is actually only can shift the crossing point in the momentum space, but not going to annihilate it. So the only way to annihilate wild points is that you move two wild points with opposite chirality. You move them in the K space and move them to the same K point. So at this after they meet at the same K point, they can destroy each other. So then and wild points is actually also can be viewed as a singular point in the Barry curvature. So once we have energy band, we can define the Barry connection and the Barry curvature. So the Barry curvature, a Barry connection just mimic the vector potential in the momentum space, and the barrier curvature is the corresponding magnetic field. And then wire points is nothing but the monopoles for this magnetic field. So the left and the right hand for the chirality just corresponding to this positive and negative charge in the monopole. So then we can use this picture to do lots of things. For example, in solid state, we always treat the lattice problem. So then there's a no-go theorem tells us that for any lattice fermionic Hamiltonian, the wire points must come in pairs with opposite charge or opposite chirality. So why is this? And in field theory, there's a very rigorous proof of that. So that in as a solid state physicist, we think about this problem in a simple way. So I just prove it in a solid state way that because we our why is that the most important reason for that is that the momentum space we live in is a compact space. So for example, this is the brain zone of any crystal. So this is the z direction. So Kz equals to minus pi, and the Kz equals to plus pi. They are actually the same point. So this space is compact. So suppose I have wire points somewhere in the three-dimensional K space. So then let me consider a problem with a constant Kz sheet in the three-dimensional brain zone. So then we start from, for example, Kz equals to minus pi, and slowly shift this Kz all the throughout the whole brain zone. So then because of the constant Kz sheet is a two-dimensional system. So we can define a Chern number for this two-dimensional system. Then it must be an integer. So then once you move around the K space, as long as the gap didn't close, the Chern number didn't change because it's a smooth change. Then once you the Chern number can change only when you this constant Kz sheet actually meet a wire point at some Kz. So then it's easy to prove that once it meet the wire points, the Chern number of this constant Kz sheet will jump by plus one if this wire point is left hand, by minus one if it's right handed. So then how to prove this is actually also very simple, because consider two sheets, one below and one above the certain wire points. Then we consider object like this, so formed by this up sheet and the lower sheet, and also by the four side surface. So because of the flux flow on all the four side surface will cancel each other, because this side the side surface on the left is equivalent to the side surface on the right. So the flux flow from inside to outside on the left is equivalent to flux flow from outside to inside on the right. So they exactly cancel each other. This is again because of the momentum, the K space is compact. So that's why all the contributions from the side surface, they cancel out. So then the flux flow on the up surface and the lower surface, the contribution is just the difference of their two numbers. So then we know that the total flux flow on all these six surfaces is equal to the total charge inside enclosed by this object. So then if there's one wire point enclosed by this object, the turn number jump must equal to that the charge of that wire points. So that's why once this constant KZ sheet meet a wire point, the turn number will jump. So then if we move it from minus pi to plus pi, so it will, suppose it will meet a wire point with positive charge at somewhere and the turn number jump from 0 to 1, it must meet another one with opposite charge at somewhere else to let the turn number jump back. Because once you move to pi, because pi is equivalent to minus pi, this turn number must come back to its original value. So that's why the wire points must pair. It generates a turn number jump at some k point. It must generate another one at some another kz. So they must pair. So then another very important property of the wire set metal unique in solid state is that it will generate Fermi arc states on the surface. And so we know that for any metallic system, there is a Fermi surface. So the Fermi surface must be a closed manifold. But in wire set metal on the surface, it has a very unique property that the Fermi surface can be open. So why is that? Again, we can use the argument from the flux flow of the magnetic field in the K space to prove that. So suppose we have wire points in the three-dimensional K space. Again, we can assume that we have a small cylinder enclose these wire points. So because this K space is compact, so this cylinder is equivalent to a torus. So then if it's enclosed a wire points, so the total flux flow from inside to outside on this cylinder will be equal to the turn number of this cylinder. So then if this cylinder or torus enclose only one wire point, the total turn number of this object must be 1. So then if you generate a surface along the z direction, for example, then you will have a chiral edge mode on the edge of this cylinder on this project on this surface. So suppose this edge is actually a circle enclose these wire points. So the wire points also project to the same surface. So then the cylinder is actually project to a circle enclose this wire point. Then the turn number equals to 1 tell us that there must be only one Fermi surface crossing point on this circle. And you can change the size of the circle. You can by changing the size of the cylinder. As long as the cylinder encloses the same wire point, this conclusion just stands. So there is one Fermi surface cut for all those cylinders that enclose the wire points with different radius. So then these points actually generate just one Fermi surface cut from start from the one this wire point. It must end up at another wire point with an opposite chirality. So then in real material, it often happens that this wire points is not the only Fermi surface in this material. There's, in many cases, there is also a three-dimensional Fermi surface. So suppose the three-dimensional Fermi surface will project on the surface as the big the blue area, for example. So then As long as these big blue area, they do not connect, we can apply the same argument by using this kind of cylinder. And then the Fermi arc is actually outside this blue area is still protected. So then, but inside the blue area, there's no more protection because you cannot make cylinders inside this place because inside this blue area, the system is not gapped. So you're no longer allowed to have a fully gapped system to define the Chern number. So then the Fermi arc will be fully destroyed if these two blue area, they have some finite overlap. So then the Fermi arc will completely lose protection. But as long as these three-dimensional Fermi surface, they do not connect, there is protection for the Fermi arc.
So it's possible to have wild points without Fermi arcs at all?
But in this case, wild points itself has it must coexist with the three-dimensional Fermi surface.
Right, so like
So then a very important question to ask is where to find these wild side metal materials. So we know that in order to have a wild side metal, we need to remove the spin degeneracy of the band. So then we have two ways to do that. One is use the time reversal symmetry breaking. You consider some magnetic state, then to remove the spin degeneracy. The other way is to use the spin orbital coupling together with inversion symmetry breaking. So in this case, because for example, we have the Rochefort coupling, which also split the bands in into two. So then in this case, we can also have a non-degenerate band. So then the first proposed real material is this iridate material with the parachloral structure. So it was proposed by Shengang Wen and Sergei Savarasov and Ashwin. Then they proposed that this material, if they form the local moment on the iridium atom, they form all-in, all-out spin structure. So that in this case, you have chance to realize this wild side metal phase. But this is so far it's only a theory proposal. There's no proof, no realization of that. And so after that, our group proposed another magnetic material, mercury chromium selenide. So this material has a very relatively simple ferromagnetic order. So then we propose that inside the ferromagnetic order, if the magnetization is strong enough, it will generate a band inversion and wild points. But again, this proposal has not been realized in real materials. Then there's another proposals by these people, by Murakami's group, and also another proposal by Vandenberg's group about generate wild points in real material by inversion symmetry breaking. But again, these two proposals have not been realized in the materials. So then in the beginning of last year, we published a paper about this class of materials, tellurium arsenic and tellurium phosphide, a niobium arsenic and a niobium phosphide. So we propose that these four materials have very similar crystal structure and also electronic structure. So then there are 24 wild points sitting very close to the Fermi level. So this is the crystal structure of the four materials. You will see the difference is small. Even the lattice constant difference is small. If you look at the structure, the symmetry of the structure just gave us just two mirror planes. And there's one mirror plane along the XZ plane and the YZ plane. And also there are two diagonal planes illustrated by this dashed line. So for the this two diagonal plane, they are not a mirror plane, they are the glide mirror plane. So if you do electronic structure calculation using DFT, you calculate the band structure. If you do it without spin-orbital coupling, you will already see a very clear band inversion features along these lines. So all the this band crossing features, they generate crossing point. The crossing point is actually, they form six rings in the momentum space. And those rings are all located on the mirror invariant plane. So the reason of that is that on this plane, all the states can be classified according to the mirror eigenvalue. So these two states, these two bands, they cross, they belong to two different mirror eigenvalue, and so they do not hybridize. So these crossing points is actually, they are protected by symmetry, by mirror symmetry. But once you turn on spin-orbital coupling, you can open gap on these points. So then we turn on spin-orbital coupling, and that,
yeah. Somehow, that where the dispersion along
They are not located at the same energy. So that's true. This is we only plotted in the momentum space. So I will emphasize the crossing point are not on the same energy. So once you turn on spin-orbital coupling, you will split these all these crossing points. And the question is, when you turn on spin-orbital coupling, we know that the crossing points at the high symmetry plane will be lifted. So the gap will fully open on this mirror invariant plane. So the question is that possible that there's some isolated points, the gap remains unopened on these points off the plane? So, yeah. To answer the question,
before you go on, yeah. So was there some reasoning behind choosing looking at this particular family, or you just kind of found it randomly?
And there's one actually very important property I forgot to mention is that the diamagnetic sensibility. So if you look at the magnetic sensibility of this of these materials, they have a very big diamagnetic sensibility. So the magnetic sensibility is actually positive in high temperature. So once you go to very low temperature, the sensibility will change sign, will tend to become negative. So this is a very strong hint of that there probably has some wild points in the band structure. Because in the diamagnetic contribution from the Landau level, this means the Landau level contribution actually overcomes the Pauli contribution. So that means that the Fermi surface will probably very, very tiny. So yeah. So from that hint, we know that probably there is crossing points in the momentum space. But to find those points are actually very difficult because you are looking for isolated points in a three-dimensional manifold. So then the way we find it is by actually calculating so-called the Millerton number. So I will explain. So again, this is the top view of our brain zone. So we have two mirror environment plane. It's the XZ mirror and the YZ mirror. So along these two mirror environment plane, we can define a Millerton number. So on this plane, all the space can be classified in by its mirror eigenvalue. And we look at a subspace with the same mirror eigenvalue. So time reversal symmetry actually will map one mirror eigenvalue to the other. And then within this one subspace with the same mirror eigenvalue, there's no time reversal symmetry. And we can define the Chern number of this subsystem. So then this is called mirror Chern number. It's first proposed by Liang Fu to classify a class of so-called topological crystalline insulator. So then we calculate the mirror eigenvalue for these two mirrors. And we see that the mirror eigenvalue is, the mirror Chern number is one. Then that means there is chiral edge mode on these two points. So these chiral edge modes cannot just cannot just disappear if we move away from the mirror environment plane. So it must become a line if you move away from the mirror environment plane. So then the question is, if these Fermi lines will connect to each other to form a closed Fermi surface or not? So if they form a closed Fermi surface, then the system is actually a topological insulator. So you have a non-trivial Fermi surface on the surface, because this Fermi surface has no degeneracy. It's odd numbers of Fermi circles enclosing a high symmetry point. So this is a topological insulator. But if they cannot connect to each other, they form some separated lines or arcs, then there must be wire points exist in the three-dimensional band structure. So then if case one or case two can be realized, will be depends on the situation on these two diagonal planes. And we know that on the two diagonal plane, although there's no mirror symmetry, we still have the time reversal symmetry because it's time reversal invariant plane. And we can define a Z2 topological number for these two diagonal planes. And we calculate the Z2 number for this two diagonal plane, and we see that Z2 is trivial. So there's no like topological surface states on this two diagonal plane. So then these Fermi lines, they must stop at somewhere between this solid plane and the dashed plane. So they must form Fermi arc, and which implies that there must be wire points in the three-dimensional band structure. So then,
why can't you just calculate Chern numbers on slices?
Yeah. I'm going to tell you about that. Yeah, but this mirror Chern number is actually just tell us there must be wire points, but didn't tell us how many of them, but after calculated the number, you'll know that they must be wire points. Then by calculating the Chern numbers of the small slides, you are able to determine how many of them in the brain zone. So we actually mapped out all the full pattern of the Barry curvatures on each constant KZ plane. And the wire points actually appear as the source and the drain in this Barry curvature plot. So then we find that there are eight of them in KZ equals zero plane, and at some another KZ, we found another eight actually pairs. Then totally in this material, there are 24 of the wire points. They actually, so this is the small movie of just showing you the location of those wild points. So they can be classified into two classes. So one class is located at kz equal to zero plane, and the other one is off the kz equal to zero plane. So then they appear at two different energy. Then, but they are not, they are quite close to each other. So the energy difference of these two wild points is within the 20 millivolts. So yeah, so it's not too bad. So this is a side view. This is a top view of the location. Then after that, we calculate the surface states for the real material. And we do see those Fermi arcs connecting these two wild points with opposite chirality. So because we know that the Muir number on these two planes are one, then this Muir number is also put a strong constraint on the behavior of Fermi arc the connection pattern. Because we have 24 of them project to the surface. For example, project to 001 surface, there will be 16 projection points. So there are many ways to connect those 16 points. Then the Muir number that should tell us that there must be one chiral mode here, there must be one chiral mode there. So this actually help us to reduce the number of possible connecting pattern. And now, also, we calculate the connecting pattern on the side surface as well. So then, after our theory, my colleague in IOP, they grow the single crystal, and then my another colleague, Hong Ding's group, they measure the RPAS. Then they do see this Fermi arc behavior on the surface, which is quite close to our theoretical calculation. So then I think the most important physics in topological semi metal, in both wild and the Dirac semi metal, is so called chiral anomaly. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have transport data?
So here is the transport. Yeah, come to that. Yeah. So the chiral anomaly is actually can be viewed as a very simple picture in the lambda level physics. So if I have a magnetic field and the electric field parallel to the magnetic field, so the magnetic field will actually form a so-called lambda level. Then along the, because it's a three-dimensional system, so parallel to the magnetic field direction, the momentum k is still a good quantum number. So the lambda levels become lambda bands. So these are the lambda bands. And then the chiral anomaly tells us that the lowest lambda level, the zeroth lambda level is actually chiral. They only disperse for each wild points. The zeroth lambda level only disperse along one direction. So then this is for chirality equals to positive one, and this is for chirality equals to minus one. So the positive one and minus one, the zeroth lambda level, they disperse to an opposite direction. Then, and the key point of chiral anomaly is that although that we know that in any lattice system, these bands must be connected at some high energy scale, but they can be connected by many different ways. But this how they connected is actually doesn't matter at all for example, the low energy transport process. So the only thing we care is the states near the Fermi level. Then under both magnetic field and the electric field, you can think about a just normal transport process. So on the electric field, the distribution function of the electronic state will be actually shifted in one direction, which generates a current proportional to actually E dot B. So this is the lambda level, the current anomaly just from the lambda level picture. So we will see that it's quite natural to have such kind of process. And because of the lambda level degeneracy is also proportional to B, so once you increase the B, you will more degenerate such chiral states and it will contribute more to your transport. So then this process actually will give you a negative magnetoresistance or positive magnetoconductance. But it seems that chiral anomaly is quite natural in the lambda level picture. But the most interesting physics is that this kind of physics already happened in very weak magnetic field. And so then in this case, you're near the Fermi level, there are actually thousands of lambda levels crossing it. So the chiral lambda level, the zeroth lambda level, is only one of them. But in this case, this chiral anomaly is already actually take effect. So then in this case, the chiral anomaly can be viewed as some by some semi-classical point of view, not lambda level. It's far before the lambda level can be formed in solid states. So then in the semi-classical equation motion, so this is actually first proposed by Professor Song, and they argue that they propose that this semi-classical motion is actually can explain the chiral anomaly phenomena in a very clear picture. So the chiral anomaly is actually happens at this term. Actually, this term can be viewed as a kind of Lorentz force. This is the normal Lorentz force. And this extra term is you can view it as a Lorentz force in momentum space. So it's if you look at it, its form is very similar to the Lorentz force in the real space. You just change from a real space to a momentum space, and then you get a term that is proportional to the Barry curvature and dot the Fermi velocity. So then it is this anomaly velocity that gives you actually extra contribution proportional to E dot B and along the direction of the magnetic field. So and this term is actually contribute to a negative magnetoresistance only along the magnetic field. So then in our institute, my colleague Gen Fu Chen, he grew the sample and also measured the magnetoresistance. And he do see in some certain magnetic field range, the magnetic resistance is actually negative. And I would emphasize that if you look at the angle dependence, so this negative magnetoresistance only exists in a very, very narrow angle range. So actually, if you change the angle by 3 degrees, this negative MR will tend to be positive again. So this negative magnetoresistance is very sensitive to the angle between current and the magnetic field. So then, so yeah.
Why is that sensitive? So, from your formula, it would seem that it should be just cosine squared.
So this is a very good point. Yeah, from the formula you see, it's just the b dot e, so it's not very sensitive. But this is turns out it's not the only contribution. So there's some other contribution to the magnetoresistance as well. So if you add them together, and for these materials, if the magnetic field is perpendicular to the current, so this is the usual way we measure the magnetoresistance. And in this case, the magnetoresistance is huge. So once you once the magnetic field just turn a little bit away from the parallel direction, you have a small component, a small vertical component. So that vertical component generates a big positive contribution to the magnetoresistance. So then the overall magnetoresistance will just turn positive in this case.
Can you separate the two and check?
It's experimentally, it's very very difficult to separate like two or three contributions to magnetoresistance. Maybe, yeah, in the future we can design some special,
if
yeah.
You know that this is just transverse to the resistance.
Right. Yeah, but it's, yeah, the one of the difficulties come from the fact that what we measured is not conductance, it's resistance. So then, theoretically, we always calculate the conductance. So the conductance can be written in a very beautiful form, but not the resistance. So in order to get the conductance, we need to measure, because it's a very three-dimensional system. So you need to measure all the nine components of the resistance tensor. Then you make an inverse to get the magnetoconductance. But experimentally, it's extremely harder to measure the transport along three directions at the same time. So yeah, but we actually found out some special way to do that. So my colleague is actually trying very hard to measure that. Yeah, you need to flow a current, for example, along the z direction. Along the x direction. But you need to measure the voltage drop at all three directions, x, y, and z. So you need your sample to be a regular shape, not like a needle or too flat. It's always very difficult. If your sample is the width in three dimension x, y, z, they are comparable, then you probably can do it. Yeah, so it's all about the shape of the sample. Yeah, so that's very detailed, yeah. So this is the negative MR. And then a similar negative MR has also been detected in Fong's group on a diroxide metal. It's a sodium bismuth. So this material has inversion center, and the bands are actually doubly degenerate. So they are two wild points, they sitting together. So it's a diroxide metal. But with the magnetic field, assume that the G factor is big enough, you can split this to wild points by the Zeeman coupling term. So they become some similar wild point, wild set metal system. So then in Puang's measurement, they see a very clear negative magnetoresistance. And at some not very high magnetic field along the 7 Tesla, this negative MR actually saturates. So then compared to the result in TAAS, you will see in this TAAS, the MR in the very, very weak field, the magnetoresistance is actually positive. So then it has a shape similar to the shape of the anti-localization behavior. So then the people will actually assume this positive MR in a very weak field is ascribed to some anti-localization effect, but they're just hand wavy argument. It's not very. There's no very solid theory about that. So then, if you compare this small positive MR in the weak field, then you see that in sodium bismuth, this small positive MR in the very weak field is actually very, very small. So in this material, it's in most range of the magnetic field, its magnetic resistance is negative. And again, it's only in a situation that the magnetic field and the current are parallel to each other, you can ever see this. And one very important point in Fuan's experiment is that in his experiment, he can change the direction of the current, because chiral anomaly only cares about the relative angle between B and E, and the current can flow to any direction in for the crystal. So then he actually checked two different crystal direction. So when in the plane, the system has some similar honeycomb structure. So this the x direction and the y direction are two different, two non-equivalent crystal direction. And then he make a sample and let the current flow in both in x or y direction. And then he checked both directions. And in each case, they can see this similar negative magnetic resistance. So that is also a very strong evidence for the chiral anomaly phenomena. Okay, so here's my summary. So I think in this talk, I have shown you that the mirror number can and the Z2 invariance can be used to identify certain wireless metal material. So and the terum arsenic family, so they have four different materials. So they are very good wireless metals with broken inversion symmetry, but it keeps the time reversal symmetry. So we hope we can find more of those materials. Thank you very much.
Do these wire metals have any special instabilities theoretically and experimentally?
Uh-huh.
What temperature, what do you see experimentally? Are they all base metals?
They are, I would say, strange metals. And we see that from the accessibility, ordinary metal will be accessibility. It's a positive spin contribution will be a dominant. But in this semi-metal material, in the low temperature, the Landau contribution, a diamagnetic contribution will actually take over. So you will see a very big negative negative accessibility.
So no longer in the order.
No longer in the order. So yeah, there's no phase transition at all. Just And also this magnetic resistance is very strange. It is very sensitive to the direction of the magnetic field. If it's parallel to the current or perpendicular, the behavior will be completely different. Yeah.
Do you know why this magnetic resistance is so much stronger in sodium 3 bismuth than in tantalum arsenide?
Yeah, so far we don't have a clear answer for that, but maybe it is due to that in tantalum arsenic, we have 24 of wild points. So and they belongs to two class with two different energies. So there's contributions from two different kinds. But in the sodium bismuth, we have only, in terms of wire points, we have only four of them. So that, and they related by inversion symmetry. So they are at the same same energy. And the material is, I think, is more easier to handle for sodium bismuth because it's a very good layered material. Then, yeah, this probably is one of the reasons, at least. I think. I think they're both very metallic. Because although the carrier density is very low, but the mobility is quite high. So, yeah.
But in the last slide,
yeah.
Without B field, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see if it exposes zero, low temperature.
And you mean, this is RH, the hole.
The right one.
Right. Uh-huh. No, no. In tantalum arsenic, it's a very good metallic behavior. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so. Maybe it's due to the carrier density is very low because in this sample, they do tune the chemical potential to make it very close to the crossing point so that the carrier density is very low.
Actually, how large is the interaction in this material? In the talk, you did not mention any potential.
But all these materials, they are actually belongs to a weak corrated material, so I don't think correlation effect will play an important role here. But
so in this LDA calculation, this U.
No, we never put any U in this kind of system.
So it's already
because the wide, yeah, the band is very wide. There's no band renormalization.
Is there any kind of potential material with large U?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, one of my hobbies is actually heavy fermion material. So, there's one important feature in this wild cell metal is the tunability. So, if we can we can shift the position of the wild points by a very big amount by if you apply external field or pressure or some other effect, if you can tune it largely tune the position of the white cell metal, then we can actually generate lots of interesting physics. Then in heavy fermion, because the energy scale, the coherent energy scale is very small, so a small external field can make huge difference in the effective low energy Hamiltonian. So yeah. So then we hope that that will be like, if we can find one heavy fermion wild cell metal, that would be perfect.
You may still have to do experiment very
much. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
It's good that it's been small, but
right. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah.
Tungsten is a D electron.
Tungsten is 5D.
It's 5D. Like,
yeah.
So correlation may not be
no. The correlation is that you have to compare the bandwidth. The bandwidth here is quite big. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe let us
thank you.